GDP, or gross domestic product, is a strange statistic in modern political debate. Economists point out that it fails to capture the value of an increasingly digital economy, but it remains the measure most politicians and the media pay attention to. According to GDP, if a mother decides to go out to work as a childminder and pay a childminder to look after her own child, rather than look after the child herself, that is increased GDP, despite the fact the same number of children are being looked after by the same number of people. So should we be looking to alternative measures, perhaps ones which measure a country's social and economic performance more holistically? Recently, New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern has backed a different approach for government decision-making altogether. We are not just relying on gross domestic product, but also how we are improving the well-being of our people, said her finance minister. So are our leaders too obsessed with growth, playing the numbers game and failing to build what Liberal Democrat leader Joe Swinson calls an economy that puts people and planet first? Joining me to discuss the best ways to measure a country's economic performance is the IEA's Senior Academic Fellow, Professor Philip Booth. Hi, Philip.
Hello there.
Philip, can you start by telling me about the paper that you published? It was a book, actually, wasn't it? In 2012?
Yes, yeah. That's right.
On this very theme, what were your findings in that?
Well, our findings were that there were quite a lot of myths around this whole literature or around this whole discussion and debate about what is often described as well-being or happiness economics. In particular, the latest research does suggest that there is an increase in well-being as national income or as incomes increase. There is something called the Easterlin paradox, which suggests that well-being stops increasing once incomes reach a certain level. But in fact, no, closer analysis of the data suggests that this isn't the case. But it also showed a number of other things. And one is that there are various contradictory signals in the well-being data, some things which are counterintuitive and that you wouldn't expect. And that actually allowing people to be free in and of itself seems to increase well-being. So perhaps politicians should be focusing not on trying to promote well-being directly by some top-down approach of centrally planning the economy to maximise well-being, but actually just by allowing people to be free to pursue their own objectives as long as they are broadly compatible with the flourishing of society as a whole.
But I think New Zealand's Prime Minister would argue that that is the aspiration, because she argues that the purpose of government spending is to ensure citizens' health and life satisfaction, and not with a sort of dogged focus on wealth and economic growth.
That may be the case, but in that case, it raises the question of what is she contributing to the debate? If, in fact, you look at political manifestos in the last 10 or 20 years, you'll find remarkably little mention of national income growth as some kind of target, or indeed any kind of a good thing in and of itself. And if you actually look at the policies governments have followed, for good or for ill, many of those clearly constrain economic growth in order to meet other objectives. So our land use planning policy hugely raises house prices, probably lowers productivity growth, raises the cost of living and reduces living standards, but it's trying to pursue other objectives. I would argue that it pursues those other objectives really rather badly, and we should reform land use planning policy. But nevertheless, no, it is the objective of government not to maximise growth in this area, but it's pursuing other objectives as well. Rightly or wrongly, the government taxes us and spends at a level which is probably twice as great as the level that would be necessary if we were to maximise economic growth. Across a whole range of measures, if you look at government pronouncements, day in, day out, very few of them are actually concerned with maximising economic growth. This is a total red herring that she's introduced.
So growth doesn't just give us the resources needed for public services. It's what it has meant we've escaped the grind and poverty that defined humanity's existence for thousands of years. And just as it did away with impediments to well-being in the past, it can do so again in the future. So why then do you think that, you know, among these this woke set of politicians, do you think policy leaders seem to be clambering over each other to push for a fundamental rethink, whatever that means, of policy making, hoping to build an economy that puts people and the planet first?
Well, I think, firstly, politicians always want to look as if they are being original, and they also want to look as if they are being original in a way which promotes welfare, but is not to anybody's detriment. So if you are saying that you're going to put people and the planet first, well, actually, there's not much left, is there, once you've dealt with people and dealt with the planet? So who would disagree that we want an economy that puts people and the planet first? The question is, what kind of an economy is one that puts people and the planet first? Is it one that in which we have more regulation and top-down central planning of economic activity, more taxation and more government spending? Or is it one where people are freer, there's more decentralisation of decision-making, and there are more and better market mechanisms for dealing with economic problems? They are the fundamentals of economic and political debate. To simply say that we want to put people and the planet first is really taking us absolutely nowhere in debating terms. Which politician is going to stand up and say, I want to put the planet last and the people next to last?
True. I mean, eco-protesters Extinction Rebellion have welcomed this move against growth. They want an anti-growth agenda. But I mean, you've wrote very eloquently in the past about the fact that development and economic growth is actually part of the solution to climate change, not the problem. I wonder if you can just explain why you believe that.
Yeah, I'm not so sure that economic growth is part of the solution to climate change, but it does give us the resources to be more resilient in the face of climate change. Now, as much as anybody else, I'm concerned about climate change and other environmental issues which are related to it. And I'm particularly concerned that there are a number of government policy areas where what governments do actually is both anti-economic growth and bad in terms of the environmental agenda. For example, not pricing roads properly, implicitly subsidising the consumption of domestic fuel and these kinds of things. And those should be addressed by politicians. But then it does have to be accepted, and some green activists are willing to accept this, others are not, that there is a trade-off, that if we are become a less carbon-intensive economy, we are going to reduce economic growth. And if we reduce economic growth for poorer communities, for poorer countries, then it's likely to make them less resilient when there are climate events, when there are situations, whether it be extreme rainfall, wind or whatever, which leaves communities exposed. Richer countries can deal with these things much better than poorer countries. So there is a trade-off, and we ought to have an intelligent discussion about this trade-off. But also, the government should actually start by thinking about how its actions are both anti-growth, anti-welfare, and anti the environment, and perhaps it should start with a do no harm agenda.
Because in going back to New Zealand, which I think is the first major economy which is actually, well, which has renamed their, I guess, economic yearly forecast, well-being forecast, and put forward all of these policies which they argue will focus on things like mental health, like the environment, etc., etc. But she's actually said that empathy is the trait most needed in political leaders nowadays. So do you, I mean, there seems to be an argument there that the only way that we can be empathetic towards our voters, or their voters rather, is to move away from advocating rampant capitalism of the sort that caused the financial crash. Do you think capitalism just inherently lacks empathy?
Well, capitalism is a set of institutions which brings people together to cooperate in economic exchange in order and has as an important effect leads to increasing incomes, increasing welfare, and so on. In the vast majority of economic exchanges which take place, in the vast majority of economic institutions, there is a high degree of cooperation between people. In some of those situations, no doubt people are showing empathy. In other situations, people are not showing empathy. That's human nature. And the idea that it was a lack of empathy which caused the financial crisis, I think, is just purely misguided. But in any case, it's, I think, wrong to translate what we believe are appropriate characteristics for people to have in their day-to-day life when dealing with other people into the political realm. Yes, it's, of course, it's important that politicians have empathy, but it's also important that they exhibit prudence, so that they don't react in a way which is in a knee-jerk way, or trying to court popularity, or as we talked about earlier, simply trying to use meaningless slogans which have a good ring about them, but when you unpack them mean absolutely nothing. And actually sit back and think and reason about what kind of policies will allow welfare to be promoted, well-being to be promoted, and also national income to be increased. And I think our politicians in a range of countries lack that ability. We've seen so many announcements in recent weeks which simply involve politicians making a knee-jerk response to whatever is the public clamour of the day, instead of sitting back, being brave, being courageous, being prudent, and doing the right thing.
Do you think moves to focus on well-being, because who could argue that we should focus on mental health provision, that we should focus on being more empathetic as a society, who could argue with that? Do you think this is all just flowery rhetoric in order to make the case, well, covertly, for centralised planning and more government spending?
I think there has to be a real danger that this is the case. Nobody is against, indeed, it should be the aim of government to ensure that well-being and happiness is maximised. But perhaps we maximise it best, not by trying to measure societal well-being as a whole, but trying to have a set of policies which allows families the freedom to achieve their objectives, whether they be material objectives or social objectives, in the way which is best for those families. And interestingly, the so-called progressive politicians who often promote well-being, although there is general agreement about some things such as mental health, very often promote the very kinds of policies which we know actually undermine well-being. So, for example, I've seen very few politicians of the left who are promoting this well-being agenda who are in favour of a tax and benefit system which is more compatible with family life and discriminates less than our current tax and benefit system against family formation. I see very few politicians who promote this well-being agenda who want to deregulate labour markets to allow more people to be employed. Yet we do know that there is a strong relationship between well-being and whether people are employed. So I'm afraid, yes, it is just warm words, and there is a danger that it just degenerates into a system of central planning, when the actual objective of government to promote well-being or allow people to pursue happiness, in the words of the American Constitution, is undermined.
And we've seen, actually, going back to the idea that this is the way in which we save the planet, that actually centralised planning and left socialist policies have actually been pretty terrible historically for the environment.
Yes. Socialised economies tend to be inefficient in resource use, and this includes, in general, the use of environmental resources. So if you look at lakes, rivers, forests and so on, these were destroyed by communist governments of the past. This doesn't mean to say necessarily that social democratic governments which are broadly left-wing might be worse for the environment than governments which are broadly free market, but these are the kinds of things about which we can have a discussion. And there are plenty of policies which are on the shelf which are compatible both with free markets and with good environmental outcomes.
So if you don't agree with this measure well-being being desirable or likely to lead to sensible policy outcomes, GDP certainly isn't perfect. I mean, you gave me, Philip, the example of the childminder, for example. Its industrial era origins make it better suited to measuring the value of stuff made in factories and bought in shops, not our increasingly digital economy. So are there any alternatives?
Well, perhaps we should just focus a little bit less on the measurements of aggregate quantities. In other words, adding up everything that people produce in the economy to work out what total national income is, with all the problems that that has, or trying somehow to survey a large enough proportion of the population to see how happy they are and then come up with some aggregate measure of happiness. Yeah, this is a good idea potentially for academics to do, but when it comes to governments, perhaps they should just accept that allowing people to be free, allowing people to pursue happiness, may be more important than measuring it at the aggregate level and trying to plan the economy in order to maximise aggregate happiness as they see it.
So, Philip, to conclude, I wonder if... Let's imagine that the government brings you in as a seasoned economist and talks with you and says, come on, Philip, how can we maximise well-being? What would you do?
Oh, I would try to produce policies which maximise well-being by trying to increase individual freedom. We actually know that the more free people are, the happier that they are. There's a relationship there. I would decentralise government more. Again, people feel they have more control when government is more decentralised. And again, that seems to make people feel happier. I would then pursue a range of policies which didn't to the same extent discriminate against family formation through the tax and benefit system as our current tax and benefit system. And yes, then there are areas where perhaps government spending is important in order to bolster what could be done through philanthropy and civil society organisations, such as in relation to mental health as well. But these are individual policy decisions which need to be taken, and it should not be taken within some kind of what seems like almost a totalitarian framework of governments trying to maximise well-being by measuring it explicitly and in aggregate, and then pursuing policies to maximise that measure of well-being.
Philip, on a very hot day, thank you very much for joining me to talk about well-being. To actually satisfy our own well-beings, we need to get out of this very small room.
Mm-hmm. Indeed we do.
Thank you very much. Right, for more podcasts, films and reports, visit our website at iea.org.uk.